Chapter 18. Oubliette. At 6 o'clock in the evening, the deep bell tolled briefly from the castle, and dusk came like the slow drawing of a violet blind over the day. Crickets began to zing in a loud chorus, and geckos chuckled in the shrubbery. The pink dragonflies disappeared, and large horned toads appeared in quantities from their mud holes on the edge of the lake, and, so far as Bond could see through his spy hole, seemed to be catching gnats, attracted by the shining pools of their eyes. Then the four guards reappeared, and there came the fragrant smell of a bonfire they had presumably lit to consume the refuse they had collected during the day. They went to the edge of the lake and raked in the tattered scraps of blue clothing, and, amidst delighted laughter, emptied long bones out of the fragments into the water. One of them ran off with the rags, presumably to add them to the bonfire, and Bond got under cover as the others pushed their wheelbarrows up the slope and stowed them away in the hut. They stood, chattering happily in the dusk, until the fourth arrived, and then, without noticing the slashed and disarrayed sacks and the shadows, they filed off in the direction of the castle. After an interval, Bond got up and stretched, and shook the dust out of his hair and clothes. His back still ached, but his overwhelming sensation was the desperate urge for a cigarette. All right, it might be his last. He sat down and drank a little water and munched a large wedge of the highly flavoured pemmican, then took another swig at the water bottle. He took out his single packet of Shinsei and lit up, holding the cigarette between cupped hands and quickly blowing out the match. He dragged the smoke deep down into his lungs. It was bliss. Another drag, and the prospect of the night seemed less daunting. It was surely going to be all right. He thought briefly of Kissy, who would now be eating her bean curd and fish and preparing the night's swim in her mind. A few hours more and she would be near him. But what would have happened in those few hours? Bond smoked the cigarette until it burned his fingers, then crushed out the stub and pushed the dead fragments down through a crack in the floor. It was 7:30, and already some of the insect noises of sundown had ceased. Bond went meticulously about his preparations. At 9 o'clock, he left the hideout. Again, the moon blazed down, and there was total silence, except for the distant burping and bubbling of the fumaroles and the occasional sinister chuckle of a gecko from the shrubbery. He took the same route as the night before, coming through the same belt of trees, and stood looking up at the great bat-winged donjon that towered up to the sky. He noticed for the first time that the warning balloon with its advertisement of danger was tethered to a pole on the corner of the balustrade surrounding what appeared to be the main floor, the third or centre one of the five. Here, from several windows, yellow light shone faintly, and Bond guessed that this would be his target area. He let out a deep sigh and strode quietly off across the gravel, and came without incident to the tiny entrance under the wooden bridge. The black ninja suit was as full of concealed pockets as a conjurer's tailcoat. Bond took out a pencil flashlight and a small steel file and set to work on a link of the chain. Occasionally he paused to spit into the deepening groove to lessen the rasp of metal on metal, but then there came the final crack of parting steel, and using the file as a lever, he bent the link open and quietly removed the padlock and chain from its stanchions. He pressed lightly, and the door gave inwards. He took out his flashlight and pushed further, probing the darkness ahead with his thin beam. It was as well he did so. On the stone floor, where his first step past the open door would have taken him, lay a yawning man-trap, its rusty iron jaws perhaps a yard across, waiting for him to step on the thin covering of straw that partially concealed it. Bond winced as, in his imagination, he heard the iron clang as the saw teeth bit into his leg below the knee. There would be other such booby traps. He must keep every sense on the alert. Bond closed the door softly behind him, stepped round the trap, and swept the beam of his torch ahead and around him. Nothing but velvety blackness. He was in some vast underground cellar, where no doubt the food supplies for a small army had once been stored. A shadow swept across the thin beam of light, and another, and there was a shrill squeaking from all around him. Bond didn't mind bats, or believe the Victorian myth that they got caught in your hair, and their radar was too good. He crept slowly forward, watching only the rough stone flags ahead of him. He passed one or two bulky arched pillars, and now the great cellar seemed to narrow because he could just see walls to right and left of him, and above him an arched cobwebby roof. Yes, here were the stone steps leading upwards. He climbed them softly and counted 20 of them before he came to the entrance, a wide double door with no lock on his side. He pushed gently and could feel and hear the resistance of a rickety-sounding lock. He took out a heavy jemmy and probed, its sharp jaws notched round some sort of a cross-belt, and Bond levered hard sideways until there came the tearing sound of old metal and the tinkle of nails or screws on stone. He pushed softly on the crack, and with a hideously loud report, the rest of the lock came away and half the door swung open with a screech of old hinges. Beyond was more darkness. Bond stepped through and listened, his torch doused. But he was still deep in the bowels of the castle and there was no sound. He switched on again. More stone stairs leading up to a modern door of polished timber. He went up them and carefully turned the metal door handle. No lock this time. He softly pushed the door open and found himself in a long stone corridor that sloped on upwards. At the end was yet another modern door, and beneath it showed a thin strip of light. Bond walked noiselessly up the incline, and then held his breath, and put his ear to the keyhole. Dead silence. He grasped the handle, and inched the door open, and then, satisfied, went through and closed the door behind him, leaving it on the latch. He was in the main hall of the castle. The big entrance door was on his left, and a well-used strip of red carpet stretched away from it and across the 50 feet of hall into the shadows that were not reached by the single large oil lamp over the entrance. The hall was not embellished in any way, save for the strip of carpet, and its roof was a maze of longitudinal and cross beams interspersed with latticed bamboo over the same rough plaster work as covered the walls. There was still the same castle smell of cold stone. Bond kept away from the carpet and hugged the shadow of the walls. He guessed that he was now on the main floor, and that somewhere straight ahead was his quarry. He was well inside the citadel. So far, so good. The next door, obviously the entrance to one of the public rooms, had a simple latch to it. Bond bent and put his eye to the keyhole. Another dimly lit interior, no sound. He eased up the latch, inched the door ajar and then open, and went through. It was a second vast chamber. But this time, one of baronial splendour, the main reception room, Bond guessed, where Blofeld would receive visitors. Between tall red curtains, edged with gold, fine set pieces of armour and weapons hung on the white plaster walls, and there was much heavy antique furniture arranged in conventional groupings on a vast central carpet in royal blue. The rest of the floor was of highly polished boards, which reflected back the lights from two great oil lanterns that hung from the high timbered roof, similar to that of the entrance hall, but here with the main beams decorated in a zigzag motif of dark red. Bond, looking for places of concealment, chose the widely spaced curtains and slipped softly from one refuge to the next, reached the small door at the end of the chamber that would, he guessed, lead to the private apartments. He bent down to listen, but immediately leaped for cover behind the nearest curtains. Steps were approaching. Bond undid the thin chain from around his waist, wrapped it round his left fist, and took the jemmy in his right hand, and waited, his eyes glued to a chink in the dusty-smelling material. The small door opened halfway, to show the back of one of the guards. He wore a black belt with a holster. Would this be Kono, the man who translated for Blofeld? He had probably had some job with the Germans during the war, in the Kempe Tai, perhaps. What was he doing? He appeared to be fiddling with some kind of apparatus behind the door. A light switch? No, there was no electric light. Apparently satisfied, the man backed out, bowed deeply to the interior, and closed the door. He wore no masque, and Bond caught a brief glimpse of a surly, slit-eyed, brownish face as he passed Bond's place of concealment and walked on across the reception chamber. Bond heard the click of the far door, and then there was silence. He waited a good 5 minutes before gently shifting the curtain so that he could see down the room. He was alone. And now, for the last lap. Bond kept his weapons in his hands and crept back to the door. This time, no sound came from behind it. But the guard had bowed. Oh, well, probably out of respect for the aura of the master. Bond quietly but firmly thrust the door open and leaped through, ready for the attacking sprint. A totally empty, totally featureless length of passageway yawned at his dramatics. It stretched perhaps 20 feet in front of him. It was dimly lit by a central oil lamp, and its floor was of the usual highly polished boards. A nightingale floor. No. The guard's footsteps had uttered no warning creaks, but from behind the facing door at the end came the sound of music. It was Wagner, the Ride of the Valkyries, being played at medium pitch. Thank you, Blofeld, thought Bond. Most helpful cover. And he crept softly forward down the center of the passage. When it came, there was absolutely no warning. One step across the exact halfway point of the flooring, and like a seesaw, the whole 20 feet of board swiveled noiselessly on some central axis, and Bond, arms and legs flailing and hands scrabbling desperately for a grip, found himself hurtling down into a black void. The guard, the fiddling about behind the door, he had been adjusting the lever that set the trap, the traditional oubliette of ancient castles, and Bond had forgotten. His body plunged off the end of the inclined platform into space. An alarm bell, triggered by the mechanism of the trap, brayed hysterically. Bond had a fractional impression of the platform, relieved of his weight, swinging back into position above him. Then he crashed shatteringly into unconsciousness. Bond swam reluctantly up through the dark tunnel towards the blinding pinpoint of light. Why wouldn't someone stop hitting him? What had he done to deserve it? He had got 2 awabis. He could feel them in his hands, sharp-edged and rough. That was as much as Kissy could expect of him. Kissy, he mumbled, stop it, Kissy. The pinpoint of light expanded, became an expanse of straw-covered floor on which he was crouching while the open hand crashed sideways into his face, piff, paff. With each slap, the splitting pain in his head exploded into 1,000 separate pain fragments. Bond saw the edge of the boat above him and desperately raised himself to grasp at it. He held up the awabis to show that he had done his duty. He opened his hands to drop them into the tub. Consciousness flooded back, and he saw the 2 handfuls of straw dribble to the ground. But the blows had stopped. And now he could see, indistinctly through a mist of pain, that brown face, those slit eyes, Kono, the guard. And someone else was holding a torch for him. Then it came back. No awabis, no Kissy. Something dreadful had happened. Everything had gone wrong. Shimata, I have made a mistake. Tiger. The clue clicked, and total realization swept through Bond's mind. Careful now. You're deaf and dumb. You're a Japanese miner from Fukuoka. Get the record straight. To hell with the pain in your head. Nothing's broken. Play it cool. Bond put his hands down to his sides. He realized for the first time that he was naked, save for the brief V of the black cotton ninja underpants. He bowed deeply and straightened himself. Kono, his hand at his open holster, fired furious Japanese at him. Bond licked at the blood that was trickling down his face and looked blank, stupid. Kono took out his small automatic, gestured. Bond bowed again, got to his feet, and, with a brief glance round the straw-strewn oubliette into which he had fallen, followed the unseen guard with the torch out of the cell. There were stairs, and a corridor, and a door. Kono stepped forward and knocked. And then Bond was standing in the middle of a small, pleasant, library-type room, and the second guard was laying out on the floor Bond's ninja suit and the appallingly incriminating contents of his pockets. Blofeld, dressed in a magnificent black silk kimono across which a golden dragon sprawled, stood leaning against the mantelpiece beneath which a Japanese brazier smoldered. It was him, all right. The bland, high forehead, the pursed, purple wound of a mouth, now shadowed by a heavy, grey-black moustache that dropped at the corners on its way, perhaps, to achieving Mandarin proportions, the mane of white hair he had grown for the part of Monsieur le Comte de Bleuville, the black bullet holes of the eyes, and beside him, completing the picture of a homely couple at ease after dinner, sat Irma Bunt, in the full regalia of a high-class Japanese lady, the petit point of a single chrysanthemum lying in her lap, waiting for those pudgy hands to take it up when the cause of this unseemly disturbance had been ascertained. The puffy square face, the tight bun of mousy hair, the thin, wardrous mouth, the light brown, almost yellow eyes. By God, thought Bond dully, here they are, within easy reach. They would both be dead by now but for his single criminal error. Might there still be some way of turning the tables? If only the pain in his head would stop throbbing. Blofeld's tall sword stood against the wall. He picked it up and strode out into the room. He stood over the pile of Bond's possessions and picked them over with the tip of the sword. He hooked up the black suit. He said in German, "And what is this, Connor?" The head guard replied in the same language. His voice was uneasy, and his eye-slits swiveled with a certain respect towards Bond and away again. "It is a ninja suit, Herr Doctor. These are people who practice the secret arts of ninjutsu. Their secrets are very ancient, and I know little of them. They are the art of moving by stealth, of being invisible, of killing without weapons. These people used to be much feared in Japan. I was not aware that they still existed. This man has undoubtedly been sent to assassinate you, my lord. But for the magic of the passage, he might well have succeeded." "And who is he?" Blofeld looked keenly at Bond. "He is tall for a Japanese." "The men from the mines are often tall men, my lord. He carries a paper saying that he is deaf and dumb, and other papers which appear to be an order, stating that he is a miner from Fukuoka. I do not believe this. His hands have some broken nails, but they are not the hands of a miner."
"I do not believe it either, but we shall soon find out."
Blofeld turned to the woman.
"What do you think, my dear? You have a good nose for such problems. The instincts of a woman."
Irma Bunt rose and came and stood behind him. She looked piercingly at Bond, and then walked slowly round him, keeping her distance. When she came to the left profile, she said softly, with awe,
"Du lieber Gott."
She went back to Blofeld. She said in a hoarse whisper, still staring, almost with horror, at Bond,
"It cannot be, but it is. The scar down the right cheek, the profile, and the eyebrows have been shaved to give that upward tilt."
She turned to Blofeld. She said decisively,
"This is the English agent. This is the man, Bond, James Bond, the man whose wife you killed, the man who went under the name of Sir Hilary Bray." She added fiercely, "I swear it! You have got to believe me, lieber Ernst!"
Blofeld's eyes had narrowed.
"I see a certain resemblance. But how has he got here?
How has he found me? Who sent him?
The Japanese Geheimdienst. They will certainly have relations with the British Secret Service.
I cannot believe it. If that was so, they would have come with warrants to arrest me. There are too many unknown factors in this business. We must proceed with great circumspection and extract the whole truth from this man. We must at once find out if he is deaf and dumb. That is the first step. The question room should settle that. But first of all, he must be softened up. He turned to Kono. Tell Kazuma to get to work.
Chapter 19. The Question Room. There were now 10 guards in the room. They stood lined up against the wall behind Kono. They were all armed with their long staves. Kono fired an order at one of them. The man left his stave in an angle of the wall and came forward. He was a great box-like man with a totally bald, shining head like a ripe fruit, and hands like hams. He took up his position in front of Bond, his legs straddled for balance and his lips drawn back in a snarling smile of broken black teeth. Then he swung his right hand sideways at Bond's head and slapped him with tremendous force exactly on the bruise of Bond's fall. Bond's head exploded with fire. Then the left hand came at him and Bond rocked sideways. Through a mist of blood, he could see Blofeld and his woman. Blofeld was merely interested as a scientist, but the woman's lips were parted and wet. Bond took 10 blows and knew that he must act while he still had the purpose and the strength. The straddled legs offered the perfect target, so long as the man had not practiced the sumo trick. Through a haze, Bond took aim, and as another giant blow was on his way, kicked upwards with every ounce of force left to him. His foot slammed home. The man gave an animal scream and crashed to the ground, clasping himself and rolling from side to side in agony. The guards made a concentrated rush forward, their staves lifted, and Kono had his gun out. Bond leapt for the protection of a tall chair, picked it up and hurled it at the snarling pack of guards. One of the legs caught a man in the teeth, and there was the sound of splintering bone. The man went down, clutching his face. Halt! It was the Hitlerian scream Bond had heard before. The men stood stock still and lowered their staves.
Kono! Remove those men.
Blofeld pointed down at the two casualties.
And punish Kazuma for his incompetence. Get new teeth for the other one. And enough of this. The man will not speak with ordinary methods. If he can hear, he will not withstand the pressure of the question room. Take him there. The rest of the guards can wait in the audience chamber. Also, march!
Kono fired off orders, to which the guards reacted at the double. Then Kono gestured to Bond with his gun, opened a small doorway beside the bookcase, and pointed down a narrow stone passage. Now what? Bond licked the blood from the corners of his mouth. He was near the end of his tether. Pressure. He couldn't stand much more of it. And what was this question room? He mentally shrugged. There might still be a chance to get at Blofeld's throat, if only he could take that one with him. He went ahead down the passage, was deaf to the order from Kono to open the rough door at the end, had it opened for him by the guard while the pistol pressed into his spine, and walked forward into a bizarre room of roughly hewn stone that was very hot and stank disgustingly of sulphur. Blofeld and the woman entered. The door was closed, and they took their places in two wooden armchairs beneath an oil lamp and a large kitchen clock, whose only unusual feature was that, at each quarter, the figures were underlined in red. The hands stood at just after 11, and now, with a loud iron tick, the minute hand dropped one span. Kono gestured for Bond to advance the 12 paces to the far end of the room, where there was a raised stone pedestal seat with arms. It dripped with drying grey mud, and there was the same volcanic filth on the floor all around it. Above the stone seat, in the ceiling, there was a wide circular opening through which Bond could see a patch of dark sky and stars.
Kono's rubber boots squelched after him, and Bond was gestured to sit down on the stone throne. In the center of the seat, there was a large round hole. Bond did as he was told, his skin flinching at the hot, sticky surface of the mud. He rested his forearms wearily on the stone arms of the throne and waited, his belly crawling with the knowledge of what this was all about. Blofeld spoke from the other end of the room. He spoke in English. He said in a loud voice that boomed round the naked walls, "Commander Bond, or number 007 in the British Secret Service, if you prefer it, this is the question room, a device of my invention that has the almost inevitable effect of making silent people talk. As you know, this property is highly volcanic. You are now sitting directly above a geyser that throws mud at a heat of around 1,000 degrees centigrade, a distance of approximately 100 feet into the air. Your body is now at an elevation of approximately 50 feet directly above its source. I had the whimsical notion to canalize this geyser up a stone funnel above which you now sit. This is what is known as a periodic geyser. This particular example is regulated to erupt volcanically on exactly each 15 minutes in every hour." Blofeld looked behind him and turned back. "You will therefore observe that you have exactly 11 minutes before the next eruption. If you cannot hear me or the translation that will follow, if you are a deaf and dumb Japanese, as you maintain, you will not move from that chair, and at the 15th minute past 11, you will suffer a most dreadful death by the incineration of your lower body. If, on the other hand, you leave the seat before the death moment, you will have demonstrated that you can hear and understand, and you will then be put to further tortures, which will inevitably make you answer my questions. These questions will seek to confirm your identity, how you came to be here, who sent you, and with what purpose, and how many people are involved in the conspiracy. You understand? You would not prefer to give up this play acting. Very well. On the off chance that your papers are perhaps partially correct, my chief guard will now briefly explain the purpose of this room in the Japanese language." He turned to the guard. "Kono, sag ihm auf Japanisch den Zweck dieses Zimmers." Kono had taken up his position by the door. He now harangued Bond in sharp Japanese sentences. Bond paid no attention. He concentrated on regaining his strength. He sat, relaxed, and gazed nonchalantly round the room. He had remembered the final hell at Beppu, and he was looking for something. Ah, yes, there it was. A small wooden box in the corner to the right of his throne. There was no keyhole to it. Inside that box would undoubtedly be the regulating valve for the geyser. Could that bit of knowledge be put to some use? Bond tucked it away and racked his tired brain for some kind of a plan. If only the agonizing pulse in his head would stop. He rested his elbows on his knees and gently lowered his bruised face into his hands. At least that guard would now be in even worse agony than he. Kono stopped talking. The clock uttered a deep iron tick. It ticked 9 times more. Bond looked up at the black and white clockwork face. It said 11:14. A deep, angry grumble sounded from deep down beneath him. It was followed by a hard buffet of very hot breath. Bond got to his feet and walked slowly away from the stinking stone vent until he reached the area of the floor that was not wet with mud. Then he turned and watched. The grumble had become a faraway roar. The roar became a deep howl that swelled up into the room like an express train coming out of a tunnel. Then there was a mighty explosion, and a solid jet of grey mud shot like a gleaming grey piston out of the hole Bond had just left, and exactly penetrated the wide aperture of the ceiling. The jet continued, absolutely solid for about half a second, and searing heat filled the room so that Bond had to wipe the sweat from his forehead. Then the grey pillar collapsed back into the hole, and mud pattered onto the floor of the place and splashed down into the room in great steaming gobbets. A deep blubbing and burping sound came up the pipe, and the room steamed. The stench of sulphur was sickening. In the total silence that followed, the tick of the clock to 11:16 was as loud as a gong stroke. Bond turned and faced the couple under the clock. He said cheerfully, "Well, Blofeld, you mad bastard. I'll admit that your effects man down below knows his stuff. Now bring on the 12 she-devils, and if they're all as beautiful as Fräulein Bunt, we'll get Noel Coward to put it to music and have it on Broadway by Christmas. How about it?" Blofeld turned to Irma Bunt. "My dear girl, you are right. It is indeed the same Britisher. Remind me to buy you another string of the excellent Mr. Mikimoto's grey pearls. And now, let us be finished with this man once and for all. It is beyond our bedtime." "Yes, indeed, lieber Ernst. But first, he must speak." "Of course, Irmchen. But that can be done quickly, too. We have already broken his first reserves. The second line of defense will be routine. Come." Back up the stone passage, back into the library. Irma Bunt back to her petit point. Blofeld back to his stance by the mantelpiece, his hand resting lightly on the boss of his great sword. It was just as if they had returned after taking part in some gracious after-dinner entertainment. A game of billiards, a look at the stamp albums, a dull quarter of an hour with the home movies. Bond decided, to hell with the Fukuoka Minor. There was a writing desk next to the bookshelves. He pulled out his chair and sat down. There were cigarettes and matches. He lit up and sat back, inhaling luxuriously. Might as well make oneself comfortable before one went for the big sleep. He tapped his ash onto the carpet and crossed one knee over the other. Blofeld pointed to the pile of Bond's possessions on the floor.
"Como, take those away. I will examine them later. And you can wait for the guards in the outer hall. Prepare the blow lamp and the electrical machine for further examination in case it should be necessary." He turned to Bond. "And now, talk. And you will receive an honorable and quick death by the sword. Have no misgivings. I am expert with it, and it is razor sharp. If you do not talk, you will die slowly and horribly, and you will talk just the same. You know from your profession that this is so. There is a degree of prolonged suffering that no human being can withstand. Well?" Bond said easily, "Blofeld, you are never stupid. Many people in London and Tokyo know of my presence here tonight. At this moment, you might argue your way out of a capital charge. You have a lot of money, and you could engage the best lawyers. But if you kill me, you will certainly die. Mr. Bond, you are not telling the truth. I know the ways of officialdom as well as you. Therefore, I dismiss your story in its entirety and without hesitation. If my presence here was officially known, a small army of policemen would have been sent to arrest me, and they would have been accompanied by a senior member of the CIA, on whose wanted list I certainly feature. This is an American sphere of influence. You might have been allowed to interview me subsequent to my arrest, but an Englishman would not have featured in the initial police action." "Who said this was police action? When, in England, I heard rumors about this place, I thought the whole project smelt of you. I obtained permission to come and have a look, but my whereabouts is known, and retribution will result if I do not return." "That does not follow, Mr. Bond. There will be no trace of your ever having seen me, no trace of your entry into the property. I happen to have certain information that fits in with your presence here. One of my agents recently reported that the head of the Japanese Secret Service, the Kōan Chōzakyūku, a certain Tanaka, came down in this direction, accompanied by a foreigner dressed as a Japanese. I now see that your appearance tallies with my agent's description." "Where is this man? I would like to question him." "He is not available. Very convenient." A red fire
began to burn deep in the black pools of Blofeld's eyes.
You forget that it is not I who am being interrogated, Mr. Bond. It is you. Now, I happen to know all about this Tanaka. He is a totally ruthless man, and I will hazard a guess that fits the facts and that is made almost into a certitude by your crude evasions. This man, Tanaka, has already lost one secret agent whom he sent down here to investigate me. You were available on some business connected with your profession, perhaps, and for a consideration or in exchange for a favor, you agreed to come here and kill me, thus tidying up a situation which is causing some embarrassment to the Japanese government. I do not know or care when you learned that Dr. Guntram Shatterhand was in fact Ernst Stavro Blofeld. You have private reasons for wanting to kill me, and I have absolutely no doubt that you kept your knowledge to yourself and passed it on to no one for fear that the official action I have described would take the place of your private plans for revenge. Blofeld paused. He said softly, I have one of the greatest brains in the world, Mr. Bond. Have you anything to say in reply? As the Americans would say, it had better be good. Bond took another cigarette and lit it. He said composedly, I stick to the truth, Blofeld. If anything happens to me, you, and probably the woman as an accessory, will be dead by Christmas. All right, Mr. Bond. But I am so sure of my facts that I am now going to kill you with my own hands and dispose of your body without more ado. On reflection, I would rather do it myself than have it done slowly by my guards. You have been a thorn in my flesh for too long. The account I have to settle with you is a personal one. Have you ever heard the Japanese expression, Kiriste Gomen? Bond groaned. Spare me the Lafcadio Hearn, Blofeld. It dates from the time of the samurai. It means literally killing and going away. If a low person hindered the samurai's passage along the road or failed to show him proper respect, the samurai was within his rights to lop off the man's head. I regard myself as a latter-day samurai. My fine sword has not yet been blooded. Yours will be an admirable head to cut its teeth on. He turned to Irma Bunt.
You agree, mein Liebchen?
The square, wardress face looked up from its petit point.
But of course, lieber Ernst, what you decide is always correct. But be careful. This animal is dangerous.
You forget, mein Liebchen. Since last January, he has ceased to be an animal. By a simple stroke of surgery on the woman he loved, I reduced him to human dimensions.
The dominant, horrific figure stood away from the mantelpiece and took up his sword.
Let me show you.
Chapter 20, Blood and Thunder. Bond dropped his lighted cigarette and left it to smolder on the carpet. His whole body tensed. He said, I suppose you know you're both mad as hatters.
So was Frederick the Great. So was Nietzsche. So was Van Gogh. We are in good, in illustrious company, Mr. Bond. On the other hand, what are you? You are a common thug. A blunt instrument wielded by dolts in high places. Having done what you are told to do, out of some mistaken idea of duty or patriotism, you satisfy your brutish instincts with alcohol, nicotine, and sex, while waiting to be dispatched on your next misbegotten foray. Twice before, your chief has sent you to do battle with me, Mr. Bond, and,
By a combination of luck and brute force, you were successful in destroying two projects of my genius. You and your government would categorize these projects as crimes against humanity, and various authorities still seek to bring me to book for them. But try and summon such wits as you possess, Mr. Bond, and see them in a realistic light and in the higher realm of my own thinking.